Okay, well, theoretically, we are about ready to begin. How should we then live? Francis Schaeffer passed on to his reward. And as a faith-only type of person, you have a pretty good idea what that reward is. Okay. But his perspective on history, and, you know, a lot of these guys can be pretty good when they take a look at the general biblical basis for society. He's done a good job with that, and what he does will show you the relationships between society, its moral values, what impact those, what affect those, and eventually how they're going to relate to our current culture. And Mr. Eisnogel and I talked, and we thought it'd be a good idea for the young people to be here for this, because they're the ones that most directly impacted by this. There are some things that are a little bit questionable. Actually, nothing that you wouldn't see on a trip to Europe. Okay? But for American society, a little bit on the, shall we say, risque side. Most of your younger kids won't notice. The group that we're worried about is upstairs. And so they should, you know, talk things over with their parents. But again, most of them have seen enough R-rated stuff, unfortunately, that this will seem pretty tame. So the biblical base for this is out of Acts chapter 17, really as far as the New Testament's concerned, where Paul says that God determined the appointed times and the boundaries of the habitations of the people. The title, How Shall We Then Live, is taken out of the King James translation out of Ezekiel 33, which the I think it's verse 10, where the New American Standard translates it, how shall we survive? And so, if our equipment works, we're going to crank this up. This will be about 30 minutes in length, after which you'll get some sort of a commentary by a local expert on history. So, you want to catch him?
History and culture. This flow is rooted in what people think, and what they think will determine how they act.
There is violence and a breakdown in society up to the point in which it's unsafe to walk through the streets in many of the cities of the world. On the other hand, there is a danger of increasing authoritarianism to meet the threat of chaos in our own countries and internationally. Should we despair and give in? If not, how should we then live?
The answer as to whether we should throw up our hands and give in is no. There are good and sufficient reasons for this. We can receive help from a quarter, which would be unexpected to most modern men. But to understand how, we have to delve back into history. I will begin with the time of the Romans, because the Roman civilization is the direct ancestor of the modern European world. From the time of the earliest conquests under the Republic, right down to our own day, Roman law and Roman political ideas have influenced the European scene,
the whole Western civilization.
The Roman Empire was great, both in size and military strength. It reached out over much of the known world. Its roads led over all of Europe, the Near East, and North Africa.
All the way from Hadrian's Wall, which was built to keep out the Scots, who were too tough to conquer, to the forts on the Rhine River, to the north of Africa, to the Euphrates River, and the Caspian Sea. In one conquest, the Roman legions crossed the Alps, came down the Rhone Valley past the peaks of the Dent du Midi to that place which is now called Vevey in Switzerland.
For a time, the Helvetians, the principal inhabitants of Switzerland, held them in check and made the proud Romans pass under the yoke, ironically imitating the custom of the Romans, who had the warriors they conquered pass under a yoke. This was a temporary reversal. Not much could hold back the Roman legions, neither difficult terrain nor the armies of their enemies. They passed up over the hills and conquered the ancient Helvetian capital, Aventicum, today called Avenches.
One can imagine a Roman legionnaire who slogged home from the vastness of the north. As he mounted the hill and looked down on Avenches, a little Rome as it were, with its amphitheater, its theater, and its temples. I love Avenches. It contains some of my favorite Roman ruins north of the Alps. Some have said, although I think it's a high figure, that at one time 40,000 Romans lived here.
The opulence of Rome was here at Avenches. This gold bust of Marcus Aurelius was found here.
Rome left its magnificent treasures in art and architecture across the whole empire.
In many ways, Rome was great, but it had no real answers to the basic problems that all humanity faces. When a culture tries to build only on its military strength, very, very soon, these will prove not to be sufficient, for the simple reason that without a sufficient base of knowing what is right, what is wrong, why we should do certain things in contrast to why we should do certain others, no amount of military might is sufficient.
Rome first tried to build upon the decisions of accepted citizens of the Republic, and later on the decisions of its emperors. But the attempt ultimately failed, because it was not a sufficient base on which to build a society.
And they never had the kind of democracy we have, where everybody shares in it. But for those who were the real citizens of the state, they just tried to build on their opinions, and this totally failed. And then they turned to their gods.
This is the goddess Diana, whose temple was in Ephesus, which is in modern Turkey.
The Romans, like the Greeks before them, also tried to build upon their gods in the hope of having something big enough upon which to rest their society. But their gods were not big enough because they were finite. That is, they were limited. They were like bigger men and women, not basically different from human men and women. They were amplified humanity, not divinity. This being so, the Romans had no sufficient base intellectually. That is, they did not have anything big enough or permanent enough to which to relate either their thinking or their life. Therefore, they had no value system strong enough to bear the strains of life, either individual or political. All their gods together could not give them a sufficient base for life, morals, values, or final decisions. The Romans made their own gods depending upon their society, and when the society tumbled, their gods tumbled with them. Thus, the Roman experiment in social harmony, based on an elitist republic, ultimately failed. The Senate no longer could keep order. Armed gangs terrorized the city of Rome, and the normal functions of government were disrupted as rivals fought for power. Self-interest took the place of social interest, no matter how sophisticated the trappings. Thus, in desperation, the people accepted authoritarian government. In the days of Julius Caesar, Rome turned to an authoritarian system centered in Caesar himself. As Plutarch put it, the Romans made Caesar dictator for life in the hope that the government of a single person would give them time to breathe after so many civil wars and calamities. This was indeed a tyranny avowed, since his power now was not only absolute, but perpetual, too. After Caesar's death, Octavian, later called Caesar Augustus, grandnephew of Caesar, came to power. The great Roman poet Virgil, friend of Augustus, wrote in his Aeneid, saying that Augustus was a divinely appointed leader, and that Rome's mission was to bring peace and civilization to the world. Because Augustus offered external and internal peace, while keeping the outward forms of legal constitutionality, Romans of every class were ready to allow him total power in order to restore and assure the functioning of the political system, of business, and the affairs of daily life. After 12 BC, he became the head of the state religion with the title Pontifex Maximus. All men were urged to worship the spirit of Rome and the genius of the emperor. Later, this became obligatory for all the people of the empire. And later still, the emperors simply ruled as gods. Augustus tried to legislate morals and family life. Later emperors tried impressive legal reforms and welfare programs. But a human god was a poor foundation, and Rome fell. It is important to realize the difference a people's worldview makes to their strength as they're exposed to the pressures of life. In the Roman era, we must understand that when one became a Christian, it meant that he stood not only opposed to the surrounding religions, but the entire culture built on those religions. Back in the Roman days, when a person became a Christian and was marked as a Christian by baptism, it was a very short step at times from the open profession of faith to the martyr's death.
Rome was cruel, and its cruelty could perhaps be best pictured by the events which took place in the Roman arenas. For example, the gladiator one sees in this statue. Or the Christians thrown to the beasts as people watched. Let us not forget why the Christians were killed. They were not killed because they worshipped Jesus. At that time, many religions were practiced in the Roman world. Some were called the mystery religions. Here, for example, we can see one of the initiatory rites practiced by one of these religions depicted in this Roman house in Pompeii.
Nobody cared who worshipped whom. As long as the unity of the state was maintained, centered in the worship of the emperor. The Christians were killed because they were rebels. And this was especially so as they lost the support of the Jewish synagogues, and therefore the immunity which the Jews had since the time of Caesar. We may express the nature of this rebellion in two ways, both of which are true.
We can say they worshiped Jesus as God, and they worship the personal, infinite God only. This worshiping of the one God only, Caesar could not tolerate. It was counted as treason. This became a special threat to the unity of the state based on emperor worship during the reign of Diocletian in the 3rd century, when people of the higher classes began to become Christians in larger numbers. In the Roman era, when one became a Christian, it meant that he stood not only opposed to the surrounding religions, but the entire culture built on those religions. The early church believed that Jesus was the Old Testament prophesied Messiah, and that he had come, and that he had died in substitution on the cross. The second thing, however, is something that we're apt to forget, and that is that they really did believe that the Old Testament and the revelation in Christ and the growing New Testament, it was growing then, of course, say the first century, was God who had spoken, and that God had given truth. And as such, they were not caught in the flux of the relativistic Roman world, because it really was relativistic, much like our own day.
A weak base for a culture or an individual can only stand when the pressures are not too great. As an illustration, let us take this bridge. The Romans built many little humpback bridges like this over the streams of Europe. People and wagons went over them safely for centuries, for two millennia. But now, if someone would drive a heavily loaded truck over these, they would break. It is this way with the lives and value systems of individuals and cultures. If they have nothing stronger to build upon than their own finiteness, their own limitedness, they can stand if the pressures are not too great. But as the pressures mount, if they do not have a sufficient base, they crash. Just as these Roman bridges would crash if someone drove over them with a modern 10-ton truck. Culture and the freedoms of men are fragile. If there's not a sufficient base, it only takes time, and often not a great deal of time, before there is a collapse.
In catacombs such as these here in Rome, the Christians buried their dead and met for worship. That it was the Christians who were able to resist the religious mixtures, syncretism, and the effects of the weaknesses of Roman culture speaks of the strength of the Christian worldview. This strength rested on God being an infinite personal God, and that he had spoken in the Old Testament, the revelation through Christ, and the gradually growing
New Testament, and that he had spoken in a way that people could understand. This meant that they not only had knowledge about the universe and mankind, which people could not find out by themselves, but they had absolute universal values by which to live and by which to judge the state in which they lived. And people are unique in being made in the image of God. There was a reason for the basic dignity and value of each individual. If they had worshipped Jesus and Caesar, they would have gone unharmed. But they worshipped one God only and rejected all forms of syncretism. There was no mixture. All other gods were seen as false gods. Or we can express why they were killed in another way. No totalitarian authority, no authoritarian state can tolerate those who have an absolute by which to judge that state and its actions. Christians had a universal standard by which to judge not only personal morals, but the state. So they were counted as the enemy of totalitarian Rome. Even though many of the Christians were martyred, they had the answer, which the Romans did not have, as the Romans tried to build upon the state or upon their limited gods. The Christians continued to grow in numbers and continued in history. The Romans had the Christian answers before them, but they turned from that base, which would have given their society the answers they needed, and their society collapsed. As their empire ground down, the Romans, in their decadence, were given to a great thirst for violence and the gratification of their senses, as in their rampant sexuality. Here in Pompeii, a century or so after the Republic had ceased to exist, the phallus cult was strong.
Paintings and statuary of exaggerated sexual content adorned the houses of the affluent. Not all the art in Pompeii was like this, but that which was of sexual representation was just plain blatant.
Rome collapsed, not from external, but from internal weaknesses.
Even though Emperor Constantine ended the persecution of the Christians, and Christianity became a legal religion in 313 AD, and the official state religion of the empire in 381 AD, the majority of the people went on in their old ways.
Apathy was the chief mark of the period. The elite abandoned intellectual life for their social life.
Apathy also showed itself in the arts, with a lack of creativity. Officially sponsored art became decadent. The music became increasingly bombastic. Look at these 4th century works here on the Arch of Constantine. And in contrast, these handsome 2nd century works of art taken from earlier monuments from the period of Emperor Trajan.
This portrait of Emperor Valentinian is so much inferior to this likeness of Emperor Nero, which was minted 300 years earlier.
all of life was marked by the prevailing apathy. And as the Roman economy slumped lower and lower, burdened by a costly government and by inflation, authoritarianism increased in order to try to set off the apathy. And as less people were inclined to work, the state took over more and more, and more freedoms were lost. For example, laws were passed binding the small farmer to his land. And because of the apathy and its results and the oppression, few people thought the old civilization was worth saving. Rome did not collapse because of outward forces such as the barbarians, but because of inward rottenness. And Rome gradually became a ruin.
The conclusion I draw looking at the Roman era is the fact that nothing humanistic provides a strong enough base for society, as well as the individual life of the individual man and woman. The Greeks and the Romans tried magnificently to first build on society, on those people who made up their society, which is an exclusive elitist society. But those people, they tried to build on this and totally failed. And then they tried to build on finite gods, gods that were not the infinite personal God. And this equally failed. It brings a simple conclusion. There is no foundation strong enough for society within the realm of finiteness, and beginning from man alone and as autonomous. And the other side, of course, is that the Christians were able to stand. But the reason they were able to resist the syncretism of that day and the breakdown and face the arena, with certainty, is because they began at exactly the opposite place. They began with the existence of an infinite personal God, and that he had spoken, and they had the truth in the Old and the Testament, in the revelation of Christ, and in the then growing New Testament.
Book of Colossians. They use the word syncretism. Syncretism is just the conjoining of faiths. In other words, some of you might have seen after 9/11, there was an ad that showed up on television and showed a Muslim and a supposed Christian and a Jew all shaking hands. And the idea was that we all worship the same God. We can all get along. And, so we shouldn't have anything that interferes with the brotherhood of man. That's what syncretism is. Now, see, foundational to syncretism is the proposition that there is no truth. In other words, you can only have conflicting ideas, ideas that are directly opposite, and accept both if your underlying proposition there is no truth. Now, the Roman Empire worked very hard to allow all the religions. Now, one of the reasons that the Jewish religion was allowed was because the Jewish religion was in effect before Rome conquered Jerusalem in round figures at 70 B.C. Okay. Now, Rome itself had undergone tremendous upheaval at about that same time. It was about that time that the riots and stuff developed. inside Rome itself, to where people were crying out, "Pan e circi." That means more bread and more circuses. And it became necessary for the first time in Rome's history for their army to come into Rome and put down the mobs. Shortly after this period of time, that Julius Caesar showed up on the scene. And Julius Caesar had tremendous personal ambitions. And his goal was the death of the Republic and instituting himself as being the what we would call the emperor. He failed because of men like Brutus and Cassius, made famous by Shakespeare and others. Brutus and Cassius saw what Caesar was up to. The Roman Senate met in the forum. See, a lot of these words come down to us today. We talk about open forum. See, that the forum is the place where the Senate actually met. And Julius Caesar, even though he had various armies that he was leading out in various parts of the decaying republic, I believe it was Caesar that said, "I came, I saw, I conquered," when he took one of the provinces in the east. But Caesar would actually have his mobs there. And if a senator was saying something in the open forum that they knew Julius Caesar was opposed to, the mobs would come down, they'd actually beat the senator up. Just beat him. And, you can imagine what that did to open speech. Now, one of the greatest Roman senators that's also contemporary at this time is a man by the name of Cicero. And so Cicero also saw what was coming, and some of his speech and some of his messages have been recorded, and the warnings he gave at the time with regard to the decaying Roman society. Rome decayed. Rome imploded because, as Francis Schaeffer pointed out, they did not have a solid religious base. You turn to Colossians chapter 2, something we kind of mentioned last week, but I want to bring it up again. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 8. See, the Apostle Paul said, "See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ." Now, would-be tyrants always have as their goal the destruction of the existing social order. Because in the process of destroying the existing social order, then they can come in on the top of that and bring order. When you have the destruction of an existing social order, what you end up with is anarchy. And anarchy is the most feared of all types of human, lack of government or in areas of government. When you've got anarchy, all you've got is the law of the jungle. All you've got is might makes right. That's when you have mobs roaming the streets. That's when you have people just coming and taking what they want. Sometimes you'll see that on a small-scale riot. For example, what happened in Watts in 1964, 65. What happened in Los Angeles about 1992. Now, the worst riot in American history actually occurred during the time of the Civil War, and occurred in New York City, where they were opposed to Lincoln's drafting people. The North couldn't get enough people to fight, so they instituted the draft. And over 1,000 people were killed in the massive breakouts that occurred in New York City at that time. Now, isn't it interesting how that's kind of dropped from history? But it gives you an idea of how these things happen. Anarchy, when anarchy is in place, then the people will accept whoever can bring order. Hitler used that technique. He had the Nazis, National Socialist Workers' Party. They were in the streets. They were anarchists. And law and order broke down tremendously inside Germany. And so Hitler was elected then Chancellor of the Reichstag in an open and democratic election. That is, the Reichstag voted him to be chancellor. And, of course, the fact that 500,000 troops, the Nazi troops, were out in the mall in front of the Reichstag building, it had no effect on the election. You can you can understand that. But see, that's the nature of these guys. Hitler himself, history shows, actually set fire to the Reichstag building in order to create the final anarchy that would install him as the tyrant that he was. So the Romans, men like Julius Caesar, had the same type of agenda. But Brutus and Cassius and others actually assassinated him before he could carry out his plan. That assassination took place in 44 B.C. Now, it took clear until 14 B.C. for his grandnephew Octavian, who took the title Augustus Caesar. It took them that long for him to consolidate the power in Rome. Now, in Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he documents how Augustus was smart. That is, he kept the outer form of the Republic in place. He kept this, a lot of the same social order, and he just started shifting things really gradually to the worship of the emperor. And as Francis Schaeffer pointed out, that people were just simply encouraged to worship the emperor. Now, in 44 AD, there was a small-scale guy who tried a similar situation. He'd been to Rome. He had seen how the Romans adulated the emperor. And since he had connections with Rome, which allowed him to be installed as the local king, he was operating out of Caesarea down on the seacoast. And because he controlled the inner country, that is, he controlled Judea, he controlled Samaria, he controlled Syria, then he blockaded the food coming into Caesarea itself. And so he met with the leaders of the city, and they were able to arrange different things. And so the idea was that he would allow the food begin to flow if they would do this. And so they had a crowd assembled, and there he was. He came to take his seat on the podium and to deliver an address to the people. And the people there, the hired people that will do anything like that, they're now shouting, see, the voice of a god and not a king. See, the voice of a god and not a king. Now, while this crowd is shouting that, see, and this is an imitation of what would happen in Rome to the emperor. While the crowd's shouting that, the king, known as Herod Agrippa I, the king was eaten with worms and died on the spot. That's Acts chapter 12. Now, see, this is the setting in which the New Testament was written. This is the setting in which Christianity came into existence. Some of the statuary there, some of the gods that you saw, some of the goddesses. See, that's what Paul's walking through when he's in the city of Ephesus and he's walking through and he finds the altar to the unknown God. He's having to walk through all the rest of that. That's how it was. The worship of gods and their philosophies, the development of the Epicurean, the Stoic philosophers. These guys were the spiritual ancestors of the Gnostics that became a factor in the church toward the end or the completion of the New Testament. So the warning here is very serious. See that no one take you captive through philosophy or empty deception. Every society has its philosophy. It has its underlying assumptions and underpinnings. Now, when a person's in the middle of that, he tends not to recognize that. That is, that tends to be his reality. Sometimes it takes going to another culture or another society to be able to see, you know, how many things are ingrained, how many things are endemic. For example, in the United States of America, we have something called the work ethic. You know, sometimes the biblical work ethic or the Puritan work ethic. But the idea in American society was that you put in your time and you gave it your best, and you produce quality work for a fair wage. And that's ethos. Ethos is a Greek word and has to do, our word ethic comes from that, has to do with a whole series of habits, a great picture. See, every society has its ethics. And America's society was originally built on a biblical ethic. This would be one of the things that he kind of develops a little bit as he works through. Because Rome didn't have that ethic, Rome eventually collapsed. Now, what made Rome become so great to start with? I mean, what allowed it to go from a city to a world empire with a land area comprising a distance and scope as basically as large as the United States? And with those roads, say you could travel from London to Jerusalem. Of course, you had to cross between France and England, but you could travel by roads that whole distance. And it was marked out. Every stadium, about every kilometer, there was a marker telling you the distance to Rome.
Now we want to keep in mind that Rome and Italy are not the same thing.
Right. Yeah. Italy is just a small little country currently in existence. Rome itself was one city. It was kind of built on the backs of the Etruscans that pulled in a lot of Greek philosophy. And a lot of its ideas on the Republic came from a great Greek scholar by the name of Solon. Tom?
The major strength and the foundation of Rome was the family. And when the Roman families were strong, Rome could stand against anything. And whether it's a nation or a spiritual organization, if the families aren't strong, they won't stand. The institution will not last. It will not stand. Strong families are so vital and important in today's world. And we see the destruction of the family taking place all over the place, all over the world.
And deliberately so, for exactly the reasons we're talking about. So a lot of our words, see, like the Roman word for father is pater. You see where pater became father in English. But words like patriotic, see, that comes from, we even have words like fatherland. See, that comes from the Roman concept of the family and the development of the base for what became Western civilization. So the Republic then came into existence because of that's actually where I was going with that, because of the existence of the strong family structure, and the preservation of morals in that structure. Now, when those morals started to go, they showed some pictures from Pompeii. Anybody remember what Pompeii is? Yeah, it was a city that was covered by ash by Mount Vesuvius. Okay, it's a little bit ways south of Rome. And so Pompeii, Herculaneum, a couple others were actually buried in that ash. And so you can actually go in and see, the colors, you can see the colors, everything are actually preserved. So you could actually go in and see what Roman society was like at the time that Mount Vesuvius blew. So, see, you can already see in there the tremendous decline in morals that set the stage for the destruction, eventual destruction of the Roman Empire. Now, Christianity, see, it's really interesting. When these guys go back and they even look at the secular records, for example, the Nicene Creed, which the Council of Nicaea was called together by Constantine, working with his friend Eusebius, the bishop of Ephesus, was called together at a little city called Nicea, which was just outside of Constantinople or Istanbul today. And so they drafted the Nicene Creed. And they just listed there, we believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth and so forth. And then one of the things in the creed, interestingly enough, we believe in baptism for the forgiveness or for remission of sins. They just actually state that right in the Nicene Creed. That's why, even though Francis Schaeffer is faith only, he has to say in there their Christianity was marked by baptism, see, because that was something that was so clear that, of course, our moderns refuse to recognize. guys like Edward Gibbon, when they look at early Christianity, or what they call primitive Christianity, they're impressed with it. They're impressed with the fact that it would not compromise. Actually, would not compromise in their belief system. They would not compromise on their morals, and they would not compromise on their beliefs. Now, we know from reading the New Testament that there's individual exceptions to that, and there were problems that developed in congregations then. But overall, see, the general thrust of Christianity in the first century was a tremendous commitment to God. If we turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, we see that in some of Paul's writings here, where he compliments the church at Thessalonica. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 9, says, "For they themselves report about us what kind of a reception we had with you. See, and how you turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God, and to wait for His Son from heaven, whom He raised from the dead, that is Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come." See, one of the things that we're trying to do is we're trying to reproduce the same commitment, the same convictions that first century Christians had. One of the things that I recognized in 1970, see, I became aware of the existence of, shall we say, multinationals in conjunction with the big banks to step-by-step establish a global monopoly. I say it hit me in the face because I watched David Rockefeller use the United States State Department to alter the political landscape of Chile and use that so that Anaconda Company, which directly affects Montana, was absorbed into the Rockefeller Empire and then dismantled step-by-step so that the United States does not have the ability to wage an independent war for its, you know, should that become necessary. You know, the mine Butte still going, okay. What do they do with that stuff? You know, they concentrate it there. They pull it out of the ground at 0.6% copper. They run it through a concentrator, run it up to 52%, and then they ship it to Japan to be smelted into copper. It's systematic across the country. And I watched them do that and just simply shut it down for no good reason. I myself, you know, decided to quit in 1972. I was working at the zinc plant in Great Falls. And I, like I said, I saw this stuff firsthand. I can give you the names, the dates, the dollar amounts. And, you know, I mean, I started getting David Rockefeller speeches to read. You know, when you're 22 years old and you see that stuff happen in front of your eyes, see, it makes you think about things and where they're going. So I became aware of that, and that's, by the way, what motivated me to eventually become a Christian out of it. But I recognized from the beginning that if we weren't going to engage in the spiritual warfare that we're going to have to engage in, see, look, there's nothing new in history. See, the parallels between Rome and America, I mean, are so, I mean, you're almost reading a rewrite of history. When you look at it, it's uncanny sometimes, the parallels. Even our word Senate, I mean, where these things come from. If you look and you see certain things happening, you realize where that's going to end up, unless there's some changes. Now, the name for that change is called repentance. And so individuals, you know, nations don't change unless individuals change. That's how it works. All a nation is a collection of individuals. See, and the genius of Christianity is that it's a grassroots movement. It doesn't require any organization. All it requires is dedicated individuals taking the message of Christ to other dedicated or the other individuals, helping them to become dedicated, and just recycling the education process. That's all it takes. And there's nothing on the face of the earth that can stop it except for one thing. And that's lack of dedication on the part of the Christians. Lack of commitment, lack of conviction, lack of spirituality. That's the only thing that will stop that. Now, this is where we come in. See, this is where these things begin to apply to us. And this is why the warning against the deceptive philosophies is so important. See, a Christian actually has to come out of his culture. he really can't participate in it. You know, he can be aware of it. He can associate with the people in it. In fact, as he needs to. But he can't participate. See, no, it's subtle because it's a gradual thing. It's a gradual thing. Hollywood's a good example. See, the first time a cuss word was used in a Hollywood production was in Gone with the Wind. Okay, just one word, one time. Okay. Now, see, and that was that. You know, why was that? That's all they could get away with. Public wouldn't put up with it. So, but see, the agenda is still in place, and so the agenda is to desensitize the public. Get it used to it. Get it used to it. Push it a little bit more. Get it used to it. Push it a little bit more. Get it used to it. And that's what's going on. So here comes the message of God, kind of like a lightning bolt into that, calling the Christian out of Babylon. You know, come out of her, my people. Don't partake of her sins. See, don't participate in her destruction. See, that's what God wants us to hear out of this. And that's why these are important, because, see, we want, you know, particularly young people, we want you guys to see this. Right, Jenny Lee? Yeah, we want you guys to see this and understand, you know, where you fit in this. See, because this is, you know, this is a major important. You guys, you know, tomorrow's my 60th birthday. That means in about 20 years, I'm just out of here. You know, that's if I got a lot of strength, according to some. You know, when you realize I've already been preaching for 35 years, that means that, you know, I don't have that much time left. So, you know, I'll be able to, you know, go out of here and, you know, shake my fist in the air and, you know, holler victory on my way out. But see, a lot of you guys are going to be facing, you know, the aftermath, and so you got to be prepared for it. See, it's not like this is intended to be discouraging. It's like it's intended for you to say this is reality. You know, simple thing, simple example. You know, I kind of told this before, but when I was 6 years old, my dad got bursitis in his shoulder. And the result was he couldn't get his arm up. And since we had a wood stove, two of them actually, one for heat and one for cooking, somebody's going to have to split the wood. See, it wasn't Dad. So I'm 6 years old. That's my job. Start splitting the wood. Now, I don't know if you like the idea of your 6 year old out there handling. Dad wouldn't let me use a double bitted axe for a while. He made me use a single bit. Until I got used to it, then I could use a double bit. And, but, you know, that's my reality. Okay, I had to deal with it. And I didn't complain about it. Actually, I was kind of excited. You know, hey, I get to split wood. You know, this is going to be fun. You know, and, but it was for about the first week. You know, it was fun. You know, and it's, you know, but when you do that an hour a day, every day, 7 days a week. You know, it doesn't quite get to be so much fun. See, in other words, my point is, you've got to see what your reality is. You look at your reality, then you decide to have a good attitude about it. Yeah.
You still got all your right fingers?
I still got them all. Some of them was just a thread on occasion, but I still got them all. Yeah, split and kindling can be really, it can be really tough. So I want us to be encouraged about this. I mean, I want us to see what it is, you know, recognize it. But I want us to be encouraged, see, to know that, yes, we do have the answers. You know, one of the things I want us to get out of this is the fact that, yes, the Bible is God's Word. The Bible tells us these things are going to happen. The Bible tells us. There's no surprises here. If you read your Bible, none of this is a surprise at all. And we need to take courage from that. But we need to study it. We need to understand it. We need to get into it. And that's one of the things I really encourage you to do is really start reading your Bible on a regular basis. If you haven't got one of Bob's calendars, get one and start, you know, just start into today's date and just start reading. Because you need that. You don't know how much you're going to need it. But when you do need it, if you don't have it, it's too late. I can tell you that.